And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started.
Grooving on a Sunday afternoon.
Well, Patty Quatro, my goodness, I am still catching my breath from the last episode. I don't know about the listeners, but I'm just going to throw out some names that we talked about on the last episode, like you, the Pleasure Seekers, Dar Thumper's sponsorship with Slingerland, no less, first girl rock and roll drummer to get a sponsorship, Judy Garland, Liza Minnelli, Lorna Luft, The Who, with Keith Moon, or as Mooney as you called him, the Blues Magoos, and all the antics at the Gorham Hotel in New York City the night after Martin Luther King Jr.'s murder. I mean, I'm just, what are the words? This is incredible. I'm awestruck. I'm dumbstruck. I'm gobsmacked.
Oh, so was I, believe me. So
it's just incredible. And I just need to, like I said, now that I've had a chance to hear everything that you shared with us, and I really did not want to interrupt what you were saying because the stories were just incredible, but I do have some follow-up questions for you, a couple. And so I want to start with, you said something at the very end of the previous episode about this indelible moment for you, Patty, bandleader, for the Pleasure Seekers. And you said after hanging out with The Who and the Blues Magoos and the cops and the arrests and everything else, in your words, you said we were, quote, taken to school, close quote, regarding male bands on the road. And so I can't let that one go. So please elaborate on this notion. And the reason why I want you to elaborate is the Pleasure Seekers have such a unique perspective in this moment in time, in this rock and roll renaissance, as you called it, because you are a band. You're not a groupie, you're not girlfriends, you're not a wife. You are backstage with them touring, and it reminds me that this has been your experience with the Pleasure Seekers since your first days at the Hideout in 1964 backstage with your homeboys. And now it's 1968 and rock and roll is real, it's legit, it's not a fad, it's not going anywhere, but sex, drugs, and rock and roll were the epitome of what was going on. So I just would love to hear any of your thoughts on what you meant by being schooled that night.
Yeah, we were still very young and had started so young, and our attitude was different. Yes, we were females. Frankly, it was simply a new perspective on being on the road in the rock atmosphere and truly learning in our faces the difference of how we handled being on the road and what male bands were experiencing in a different way. We weren't completely naive. I mean, we're, 18, 19, whatever we were at that point, but not experiencing this hotel behavior that happened that night. It really was like being taken to school, learning a new reality of what life is like on the road with these male bands at this moment in time.
Well, then I have some follow-ups on that because we have spoken about Leo Fenn being your manager, who really wanted to keep a straight, attitude with the girls, no partying, keeping this mystique very much in place. Were you tempted to party with them backstage? Were your eyes wide open at that moment? Did you ever trespass over into experimenting? I'm not trying to be gossipy per se, but I mean, was there a different level of how a girl rock and roll band would be perceived versus the wild antics of The Who or anybody else?
Through that time and the future, they always flirted and wanted to hit on us. That happened. We're not stupid. We're not that young, And yeah, we had our boyfriends and stuff like that, but it was just that they always came around to then talking and whatever and having respect. It became a different thing always, even though they were trying to hit on us often. So there was that, and that happened a lot.
Well, I guess what I'm asking, and I'm sorry I'm belaboring a point here, is I understand that because you were such talented musicians. You really could hold your own. I mean, the Vanilla Fudge story is incredible in the last episode. If you didn't hear that, go back and listen. So it's not like you were token little girl, a little girl band. But I
Yeah.
guess what I'm asking is, as you were aging and getting older, and now this is the late 60s with all of this going on and this musical renaissance, were you ever tempted? Did you ever slip up? I mean, we know that it had previous band member was, Eileen Bidling Meyer was fired for partying. So how did you straddle this now new moment being on the road with male bands?
I think we just sort of avoided situations where we might get caught into something that we weren't ready for. But of course, we had our guys that we dated and stuff and were more attracted to. I mean, we partied, We weren't drinking a lot, the male bands were, but we partied. I mean, we did, but not hellaciously. That, I don't know how else to put it. We didn't do behaviors like groupies would do. Nothing like that. Nothing.
Well, and it goes back to why I think your position as the pleasure seekers in this new male rock world scenario is just so important, I think, in terms
Yes.
of history. So
Yeah.
you also said casually, just oh so casually, Patty, on the last episode, that after Keith Moon was acting up, you said, so I was talking to Roger, and then you said, Daltrey, just like, and you were saying how Roger was saying to you about Mooney, Keith Moon, about, quote, that boy was a handful. So I'm curious, and we're going to get to, yes, we are going to get to some juicy gossip, but not yet. It's not happening yet with The Who. There is more to come. But I'm curious how this dynamic between you and Roger started. Is it because you were the band leader and he was the leader? How did this relationship, if we're going to call it that, new friendship start?
I found Roger to be, even from the beginning, a little bit more serious of a person. So I think, when we talked, we had some good talks and stuff, but we're getting to know each other amongst a partying atmosphere, But he was more vocal on Mooney. Yes. I mean, Mooney was a handful. He even said it in his book later decade, I don't think it was because I was a band leader, and I don't know if he was the band leader in his band. He was real after his career and pretty serious about it. So I think I was just someone that he hadn't experienced, a young, talented female musician. It was that simple at the start. We just talked and interacted very well together.
Well, you just said something, and sure, I would say it started off that simply, but I think that he recognized in you and you recognized in him, your words, a seriousness to the situation. You are a serious Pat, and now he's serious Raj, right? So I think
Oh my
that you
goodness.
had a like-mindedness in that focus. So, okay, interesting. And again, more to come. Let's put a pin on that conversation.
Yes, more encounters. I love teasing you as much as you love teasing me.
Yes, I do. It's true. It's true. Okay, so one of the other things you said, and this really struck me, and I say this more for me, but I want to share it with the listeners because a lot of what we have read about the pleasure seekers or what we perceive of in music with genres is just a very almost black and white approach. And so you talked about recording in the studio. This is before Mercury, but you were in, well, you're already signed to Mercury, but just the Pleasure Seekers and Leo went into the studio and you recorded the Motown R&B song, Keep Me Hanging On. But as you said, you didn't do the Supremes version of it. You did Vanilla Fudge's cover of Keep Me Hanging On. And again, it really struck me that I read that. It never dawned on me that you would take any different approach than just kind of a Motown flair. And so I really want to understand how you were approaching this music and also for all of us to understand that you weren't covering it, what would be the audio version, verbatim, you know what I mean? Like note by note, like the Supremes. You were covering it because you were turned on by how Vanilla Fudge had approached the song. So I just say anything about this, Patty.
That point has to be clearly made. We were, for God's sakes, we were Motown children, brought up in Motown, okay? But like I've explained, we were radicalized and inspired by this new rock music. And that was our attitude. We moved away, we still loved Motown and appreciated that genre, but there was no way we would have gone into a studio to cover Keep Me Hanging On by the Supremes style. It was too vanilla to make a pun. I mean, it had to be that edgier version that we were performing. We had no intent to cover the Supremes one. That didn't, isn't what drew us, It was that male attitude of the heavy rock music. Even though we respected Motown and did a lot of songs in our sets from Motown, we still did it. I
Well,
mean, we did everything.
I think it would have undermined exactly what you're saying, your approach to rock and roll, because even though the Supremes are beloved, they were a front girl band. They were not holding musicians. They were not performing song, original songs or any of that. Well, and as we said in the previous episode, unfortunately, we do not have the Pleasure Seekers cover of Keep Me Hanging On, which is by Vanilla Fudge, but that's why we opened with the song in the last episode. But I do now. I'm so excited, Patty. Here we are. We are now going to get to listen to some Pleasure Seekers. So I want to just remind people about this. You have been signed to Mercury Records. They're a big deal, and I want you to tell us about this. But before we do, because Patty, you and I have covered this, and in our 30 plus episodes we've done so far. When the Pleasure Seekers started in late 1964, you were discovered by a big producer at the time, John Rhys Eddins, and a writer, Dennis Coffey, and they recorded you in on with an original song, Light, Long White Line. Unfortunately, we don't have a copy of that, but you did sing it for us a cappella, which was so cool. And then what was it? A year later, Dave Leone records You, Pleasure Seekers, Never Thought You'd Leave Me, and What a Way to Die on the Hideout label. So it was recorded late 1965, but released on Valentine's Day in 1966. And then again, this Vanilla Fudge cover that you did, but that was on your own dime. But now, Patty Quatro, this is it. This is the moment. Mercury Records has signed you, and you're immediately, according to all the press, that was the word that they used a lot, immediately about to go into the studios because of the buzz and the excitement. So, for those who may not know, Patty, as I like to say, set the stage, but also give us a history of Mercury Records because they were a big deal at the time. And no offense to Dave Leone, but this is no longer the Hideout label. This is it. So, tell us.
Mercury Records used Bell Sound Studios in New York City and another studio too. And the recordings were done in April 1968, and they were well known and at the top of their game for high fidelity living presence recordings. It was a sonic quality that they were known for, and they were so big. And here we are, the earliest female band set to record at their New York City studio. Quickly.
That's immediately. So I'm just curious, and it's only because I love the way your brain works, Patty, besides being such a talented musician. But for here's a bad pun. You have orchestrated this whole thing since 1964 with your epiphany. And now you are here you are, Serious Pat, as we've been saying and calling you. This is next level. This is a bona fide label. And they're putting money into you to record you. And so, do you have a memory of what you were thinking as you walked into those studios thinking this is it?
It was daunting. It was a big, huge room. There was an entire orchestra there because at that time in that era, they loved to have everything at the ready to sweeten, like if they wanted to add violins or whatever, horns, whatever it was. So they were ready to go to do these three sides. It felt very big time. It's hard to remember whether we did it in a couple days or 3 days. It was quick. We went in the daytime and we did it, and then maybe another day and we did the vocals. It went very fast-paced and it was very businesslike to lay down the tracks. This was big studio time. This was how they did it then.
Well, and a couple of things, because you and I talked about this privately, which is because we wanted to make sure we got everything correct here. You, Patty, told me that you can't remember if you did record during the daytime or after hours after you were performing at Arthur's. But
No.
the reason why I'm asking, though, is because you were doing this was all happening at the same time. You were recording while you were gigging. So were you nervous about going into the studio in terms of could you handle it? You said you were only there for a couple of days. You already had previous experience, but did nerves take over?
Well, we had to learn the songs, obviously. And that's what is not in my memory. I can't remember whether we started recording while we were at Arthur's. It would have been in the daytime. That's when they did their recording, this orchestral room and all that. It's in the daytime. So, and I don't, we might have started and maybe we finished right after Arthur's stopped, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously we had a gig to do at night, so we had to worry about that, but it was done. It wasn't a problem, but we just got it done.
You just said something, and so let's get to that. You said we had to select the three songs. For those who don't know the biz, especially back then, usually, especially as a new band, it would have been an A side and a B side, so two singles. So I want to take this conversation, tease this out a little bit, because I want to know, first of all, how did you select the three songs and what were the songs? Tell us about that.
The studio had the say so in what was selected. I think Corby had a big talk, a big part of that. They wanted three songs and they wanted it very commercial, pop singles for us to do. And you had to get a pop hit first. That's how they operated then. They wouldn't consider letting you do originals until you had a hit, So, and we weren't really writing yet, like we started in very heavily. So the songs were written by Mercury staff writers, just like at Motown. And the songs would be re-recorded by other bands on the label. Maybe three different bands would do the same song. It was really interesting. And I mean, they could frugally pay the staff writers who were young, and get to use the songs over and over again, and the money stayed with the studio. They knew what they were doing. It was very formula. So they picked the songs. They picked the three sides.
Okay, so I still want to tease this out though, but I do want to. So you said Corby, and just for those who may not know, Dick Corby was the producer at Mercury Records who came to scout all of you pleasure seekers. I believe it was Trudy Heller's where he scouted you, and so and he would go on to produce the songs, which is the reason why he had to see you to see if he was even interested. So on these recordings, and I still want to talk about three sides, but let's stop there for a second because Dick Horby would be producing these songs, but tell us about the arrangements by Pete Dino and who he was.
He was a Mercury staffer too, an arranger and a conductor. I don't know if he had a different name he went by, but on the records, it is arranged by Pete Dino. So that's obviously the name he went by in the studio. I tried to look him up, last night, and I couldn't find him listed in Mercury, and he was absolutely the guy that arranged the tunes.
Well, just on an aside, I texted your brother, Michael Quattro, last night because I thought he actually might know because he was in New York a lot. He said he has no idea who this person is. He's never heard of him. So it's an interesting mystery because, as you said, Pete Dino was a legit music arranger.
Oh, completely legit. He did a very good job.
So you were saying you had these young staff writers who were, we can just put words into their mouths, that they were hungry. They wanted to make it. They wanted to make it big. They had to write hits. It was not necessarily gender-based. You had men and women writers. Carole King comes to mind. But in this particular case, Patty, tell us about some of the staff writers.
Oh, it's amazing. They all have their own legacies as they became famous in time. I mean, they worked with so many major, Carol Bayer Sager, okay? She was Carol Bayer at this time. She wrote one of the hits. She wrote she wrote Light of Love with George Fischoff, and he was a staff writer. And then that one was done later by the Cherry People. And we had Good Kind of Hurt, which was written by Bob Stone. And that was also done by Kenny Rogers and the First Edition. And then we had Locked in Your Love, the third single. And that was composed by Jerry Ross and Mart Shuman. I mean, these people worked with Burt Bacharach, Peter Allen, Melissa Manchester. They won Tony Awards, they won Golden Globes. They had huge legacies as they kept writing. So, were we lucky? Yeah, I'd say we were in good talent and company with the three singles chosen by the staff writers and the studio. Much respect, mad respect for these writers that we were lucky enough to have them write our three singles.
Well, I would say, and call me biased, but I would say they were pretty young staff writers, very lucky to have you play
Oh.
their songs. I mean it sincerely, and we're going to be listening to them. And so, and you did a fantastic job. But before we go there, and I'm sorry to be such a stickler, one of the things, the reason why it keeps sticking with me, having grown up in the music world myself, is that I don't care how talented you are, Patty, and how excited everybody was. You're a new band who didn't have a hit yet. And that is, you and I have been talking about, you can be as talented as you want, but if you don't have the hit behind you, it's hard to break through. So the
Yes.
thing that I'm just struck with is instead of just going in with an obvious A side and B side, or even having to figure out which one would be which, to invest money in a
Yes.
third song. And again, I'm being a stickler on this because it's not in like today's world where you can produce a song in your own home. And I'm sure that's very obvious to everybody. But as a reminder, you had to hire people. There were unions. You had to have staff. You had to have songwriters. You had to press this. You had to have photography. I mean, there was so much that went into this that just in terms of financing alone, it says to me that they were pretty hot for you, Mercury Records. If they were willing to say, let's even go for a third, and then we get to pick which one, they really wanted you to make it.
I think that our stands at Trudy Hiller's and the word of mouth and all that, I think that that stood us very well with this particular company, Mercury. I think I have to agree, we were new, we were novel, we were gaining a rep, but we weren't a band that they already knew the name of at all, except from word of mouth. So it was pretty amazing that they wanted us that badly. And yes, we were stoked, of course.
Absolutely. One more question before we get to the singles. Later, in later decades in music, you would get what was called a financial advance or an advance in terms of any kind of monies. Did the Pleasure Seekers get any kind of monetary advances when you signed?
I don't remember. I don't think so, but I'm not sure that we didn't get some small advance. I'm just not sure. It's eluded my memory. I can't answer
No, it's wonderful. So, okay, you mentioned the songs. Let's jump to them. So the first song is Good Kind of Hurt, and it was sung by Darlene, Dar Thumper Arnone. And then, and that, as you mentioned, the writers written by Bob Stone. And then you recorded Light of Love, which was sung by your sister Susie. And then you recorded the third song, which, remind me the name of it. We're not going to listen to it today.
Locked in Your Love,
Locked in Your Love.
our favorite.
Well, that's why I don't want to play it today, because that doesn't get released. Let's just cut to the chase. But we do have it for you, for everybody.
Yes.
I really want to go into depth with that one because it was your favorite and you didn't have a say in that one. So you record the two songs. Tell us what happens after this. Because what I find fascinating, and this is, I don't know if this happened with other bands, but as I mentioned, it would be side A, side B, depending on the producer and what Mercury Records thought would be a hit. But this time they did side A, Good Kind of Hurt, as a single, and side A, Light of Love. And then it was sent out. So tell us what happened here. It's amazing.
This is a whole formula at the studios at that time. They would do this. They would do this trial stuff. And I tell you, this story, it's a bit of crazy town at the label. Mercury and Corby had felt an original intent to showcase two very different voices, Susie and Darlene. They were completely different the way they sang, their style. And it became this crazy trial period fraught with some indecision between Corby and the Suits. The first early DJ copies were with A side. Now, this is something I have to clarify. The A side was Locked in Your Love, the third single. And the B side was Good Kind of Hurt. That changed real fast, okay? Corby decided he felt the key for Susie was a tad too low. So they changed their minds, and that song was put aside. Susie wasn't happy about it. The next new DJ copies that they sent out were Good Kind of Hurt on both sides as the A side. Then again, very quickly, the four sale copies, they added Light of Love as a B side. It was a little crazy. And add to the fiasco of indecision, Mercury put both out as A to see which one would catch on.
That's,
And
wait, hold on. This is, and I'm not trying.
it's
Okay.
crazy.
So you have, it's like a promo single, side, right, A, and that would be sent out to the DJs. But then you also, so, and then you have Light of Love that would be kind of a side A. Basically, you tell us which is the side A, and they send it out.
They send it out to get reactions and data back. The trades were already picking the certain ones as pick hits. The data was being observed by Mercury, and they would sound in on the popularity of each side. So at that time, they made their decisions. Eventually, Light of Love did pull ahead in regions. So decision was finally made after this trial stuff, and that became the A side released, and Good Kind of Hurt became the final B side. And that's how it went out for sale in the final re-release.
We are definitely, this, my question for you is just a brief one because it's going to continue down the line. But because I'm curious, they're going for different vocal sounds. And in the third song, which we will get to on the next episode, Susie's voice was a little too low. And so they found a song where her vocals were a little bit higher. But as you said, Darlene's vocals were very different. And again, I just want to tease this a little bit out, and we'll have a much richer conversation about this on the next episode. But did that cause any friction within the band members? Did any kind of competition within the band come about?
Well, yeah, it does happen. I mean, it was a touchy situation. Corby, I think, disagreed with the Suits on which one he wanted to be because he favored Locked in Your Love. So did Susie. And we favored it. It was a funkier, cool song. And in the middle of all this, with this trial stuff, Mercury gets sold to Philips Records. They're sold. And now all of a sudden, there's a whole new situation going on. And we didn't understand the inner machinations of all that stuff. But Corby ends up soon after it's going on a bit, he leaves. Okay. And that was the end of that influx period. They decided the record was out, it was doing well, it was in regions and everything, and pick hits. Leo wasn't really involved in any of this. It was between Corby and the Suits, and Corby would, let us know what was going on, but That was it. It was pretty tricky. And the band, we wanted to do Locked in Your Love. I'm sure Dar wanted her song to be picked, of course, but we never got into arguments about it. Her grandmother got a little perturbed when Light of Love came back as the one that was getting the action. And I really think that was more because it was more mainstream sounding, like more pop. Dar's was a beautiful ballad with a big orchestra sound. So there was quite a difference in those two songs. And that's what they finally decided. They listened to the DJs and that's what they picked. You know, that's rock and roll.
Couple things on that. You said grandmother, so that's Lily Weaver, as a reminder
Yes.
to the listeners, who was the band's costumer and
Yes.
visionary in terms of all of these wonderful outfits that you had. She sewed them, and she also was Darlene Arnone's grandmother. And the term I've used before with Lily Weaver, and there's nothing wrong with it, but she, in today's world, she would be a total stage mom.
Yes,
She was
she would.
intensely focused on her granddaughter being the star. And
Yeah.
so I'm sure all of this came into play here. But so, okay, the Suits now at Philips, no longer Mercury Records, right, have decided Light of Love is going to be, and I get chills even saying it, is going to be the Pleasure Seekers' first single out. They felt that you had the sound, they knew that you had the looks and the talent. And so, since we have you here, Patty, why don't you play DJ for us and tell us about your first single, Side A, Light of Love? And then we're going to close listening to it and we're going to talk about your other singles on the next episode. But for now, Patty, lead us out.
Well, here we go. Finally, this hot new all-female band, the Pleasure Seekers, tearing up the airwaves across the nation with a hot new single, Light of Love. Here they are. Sound up.
Sun in the sky.